With government funding cuts to PBS and NPR, tech companies playing nice with Trump, and streamers run by algorithms, what's a reasonable reader of The Nation to do? If you're interested in politically engaged documentaries and independent global cinema, try Ovid with a free month-long trial. The Times describes Ovid as a terrific streamer of independent film fans, and IndieWire praises Ovid for being unafraid to program films that matter. A boutique, hand-curated service with over 2,300 titles, Ovid is home to films by auteurs from Chantal Ackerman to Patrizio Guzman to Peter Watkins, with the richest collection of probing, provocative films available anywhere. Sign up at Ovid today and get your first month free using promo code NATION25. That's OVID.TV.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today Charles Derber. Charles, a professor of sociology at Boston College and the author of many books, including Bonfire, American Sociocide, Broken Relations, and The Quest for Democracy. So, Charles, thank you so much for joining us. And I just want to say I really enjoyed this one. It's nice. I read a lot of sociology because I wrote an intellectual biography of a sociologist. And it's just nice to think in like these mega macro terms in a way that historians are very uncomfortable to our own gentriment doing these days. But it was a really fun book to read. And thank you for joining us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. And, you know, it's written because it's dealing with really big political issues, but it's also rooting them in very personal issues about relationships and the nature of social connections and social cohesion. I think it's a book that hopefully people will find easily, you know, accessible and personally very relevant for their thinking.
It's a light read about how America is tearing itself apart.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically like the undercurrent of our show, so it's really nice to have you on. But why don't we just dive into it? Why don't we start? You begin with this metaphor, the great societal bonfire. And so why don't we talk about, and it's, of course, the name of the book is Bonfire. So why don't you talk about that metaphor, what you mean by it, and what do you see happening in American society right now?
So, you know, the original, I note in the book that the British word bonfire, you know, we have a positive association with it, but the British original this concept was about burning the bones, was the way it was defined. And I thought of society as a sociologist and somebody who thinks about, you know, social and political issues. And I thought that this perfectly captured the crisis that we're all dealing with today, which has to do with the breakdown of social trust and social relationships and the rise of, one of the things, it's interesting that Hannah Arendt, the great political philosopher, wrote that authoritarianism arises out of loneliness. She was responding to Nazi Germany, and she was looking at, you know, she was an expert in having experienced fascism in Europe. And she made this connection between the nature of social relationships and the nature of politics. And it's interesting that, in Democracy of America, de Tocqueville also argued that the prospects for American democracy depended on the associations, the civic associations and relationships in the workplace, in the community, in the neighborhood that brought people together, created forms of trust, and built social conditions that, you know, made democracy possible. What I see happening, you know, the subtitle of the book Bonfire is American Sociocide. I don't know if you guys had ever heard the concept of sociocide before.
I actually had, but it might be worth delving into because it's not in common parlance, to say the least.
No, it's not. Yeah. And when people hear the term, they think appropriately a sociocide sounds like suicide. And that's an appropriate response because what I'm really saying is, and this is kind of a novel idea, we know that people commit suicide. individuals commit suicide, but societies can also commit suicide. They can tear themselves apart. They can create conditions for the breakdown of the foundations of relationships, ties with each other and with leaders that allow societies to sustain themselves in any kind of a viable way. So I use the word, this book is partly simply about this new idea that societies can basically destroy themselves, that they can get involved in murdering their own. I had written an earlier book called Sociopathic Society, where I argued that another sort of interesting paradox, that societies can be built on sociopathic values. In other words, societies can be organized around antisocial norms and values. And in this book, I kind of take the idea of sociopathic society and say we've gone a step further beyond just sociopathic norms that have long been part of capitalism and American militarism and are now at the stage of moving to the place where all forms of social norms are basically eroding the very possibility of social life. And that's what the book is about.
So I actually want to dig into this notion of sociopathy, which is related to Emile Durkheim,
yes.
Sociologist, French sociologist. It's probably along with Weber and Comte generally pointed to, and sometimes Marx, depending on who you're talking to, the quote-unquote founders of modern sociology. But what do you mean by sociopathic, and how has American society been organized around arguably sociopathic norms, values, institutions?
So sociopathic values are antisocial values, values that sort of erode the relationships and institutions that the society has created to perpetuate itself. It's contradictory because you would think, how could an institution create norms designed to erode its own integrity? So I think capitalist society has long had sociopathic values. That is, it's based on profit for elites at the expense of social well-being. Trump's recent budget is a clear example of that, where corporate elites align with political leaders and basically pass legislation and norms that essentially destroy the well-being of most people in the society. What I'm arguing here, though, is that we've moved beyond the sociopathic society toward a sociocidal society. In other words, a society that's become so sociopathic that it can't sustain, for example, the robber barons who created American capitalism in our first Gilded Age created very sociopathic work conditions. Back when Rockefeller became the first billionaire in the United States in 1890, the average American was making about a dollar a day, an immigrant worker in Chicago or, other industrial cities. And it was extremely exploitative. It was a very sociopathic order, but it did produce relationships that could survive. There were employment relationships that sustained themselves. They were highly sociopathic, but they created workplace. And this is one of the things that Marx pointed out, that one of the contradictions of capitalism is that it brings the workplace together in social relationships that permit the possibility of building workplace community.
Yeah, of organization, right?
Yeah, right, so that the would sociality lead to class has consciousness gone. Yeah. And so forth. Now we're moving into a second Gilded Age and to a new set of robber baron elites who have gone beyond the concept of employment. They've really said that we don't need, sort of sustained employment. We have enough AI, robots, and other kind of very temporary contingent models of employment that don't depend on the idea of any sustained relationship. So prior to this period, we had a sociopathic employment relationship, but it was a relationship that sustained the form of capital, the very sociopathic capitalism that existed. Today, workplaces are being dissolved, up to 50 to 60% of workers are now moving toward dispersed work, remote work, robotic.
I'm in academia. I have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, look at our own field. 75% is adjunct contingent labor.
Absolutely.
Look at the media. So, I only give perfect examples. Just a couple of quick questions, though, because I think it's actually important because we're talking in a sociological frame, which we normally don't. We usually adopt a more historical one. How could you talk about, quote unquote, society acting? How is society an agent? Could you maybe just talk about that for a second for people who might not be super used to that concept with like a society committing suicide? What is actually meant by that?
Well, you know, I'm coming out of a neo-Marxist framework. So when I think about society, I think about the class structure, the economic organization of the society, because, you know, as you know, the societies depend on material production that allow people to survive and reproduce and so forth. So society to me, as an agent, I don't mean to say it's just some sort of abstract agent. There are a group of people in societies that in particular kinds of societies, elites emerge to structure how societies are organized and to structure the relationships, the economic and the political and social relationships that govern the way society works. So if you were to ask me, what do I mean by society as an agent? I would be talking about the people in the society who have dominant power to organize economic, political, and cultural life. And, you know, this book looks, as you know, looks, you know, at some detail at the interests and the values of those elites and how they are restructuring society in ways that are breaking the society apart.
So then the second question I want to have before we start going into a little bit more of the elites is, what do you identify the turn as? I mean, you identified as the neoliberal turn. So maybe what happened then? Why neoliberalism then that basically pushed us from sociopathy to sociocide? What happened and why?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, I'm not the first person to say that neoliberalism, which many people don't, probably most of your listeners understand that term, but it's associated with the move toward a more globalized capitalism in which, you know, the sustainability of employment and economic survival by American workers becomes increasingly problematic. So in a neoliberal society, you basically move toward, essentially the Democratic Party in the era moved completely to abandon the New Deal and the kinds of social supports and relationships that enabled society to continue. And the Republican Party moved from its traditional corporate values and organization toward this more extreme form of market relationships in which there's a presumption that there is nothing to society other than the individual interests of particular people in the market. And so they assume, you know, they assume that society simply emerges on the basis of individual, purely individual atomization in the market with each person. It's sort of a version, a rescripted version of the American dream. The American dream says every person is an atomized individual, a me. There's no concept in neoclassical economics or the neoliberal model of capitalism of we. It's all about me. And once you move, and there are a bunch of changes that happen in the economic system and the political system that began to intensify in the neoliberal era in the late 20th century and the early 21st, that intensified this breakdown of any concept of collective identity and the movement toward a purely individualized kind of idea. And I think that's always been a very, if you were to map societies globally as to the least individualistic to the most individualistic, where do you guys think America would fit in that spectrum? If you do that, I mean, can you think of a society?
Most.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to think of a society which is more individualistic, that is more atomizes people.
Well, and the thing was, historically, I think that was enabled by the free land. Like, you could be like this, but
correct.
Honestly, with the closing off of everything that made this country what it was for the first 150-ish years, a little less, but whatever, you're going to have this sociopathy. I mean, the American thing is premised on constant expansion and free land, and then we went global, but it turns out you actually can't just live on an American imperial base in the Middle East. So, oh shit, we're fucked. Sorry to interrupt.
No, you're right. And the sociopathic, you know, values have simply intensified. And it's a continuity. I mean, Trump's authoritarianism, you know, the book argues that as sociocide develops in a society and becomes more acute, as workers become more disconnected from each other, as people in everyday life, I mean, you know, there's a chapter in the book called The Bonfire of the Vanities, which sort of looks at, I don't know if you guys saw this, but in the book, I review a lot of data from the Surgeon General and other studies. Vivek Murthy, who's written a book called The Epidemic of Loneliness in America, which he details, you know, something like 60% of Americans are now eating all their meals by themselves. Marriage has been declining. Having children is declining. Friendships and neighborhood relationships, community relationships, workplace. If you look at the entire spectrum of how people connect with other people in the society, they're all in decline. I mean, I was struck by the fact that so many people eat all their meals alone. It just seemed like a vivid illustration of this atomization of society. And so much of this book is about how this is happening, why it is happening, and what the impact is. I mean, I show that it's related to the rise of gun violence. You know, women are buying guns in, you know, the biggest new purchaser of guns because they're reflecting a sense as society atomizes, people become afraid. They don't feel a sense of support or caring. I mean, if we're all atomized individuals, me's, you begin not to trust. Nobody cares. About 60% of American workers say they're one paycheck away or one illness away from, you know, complete poverty and breakdown. And so this is the case. One of the things I learned in the book that might be interesting to mention here, which surprised me, was that there were conservative studies out of places like the American Heritage Institute, which showed that civic deserts, that is, places where people don't have public space to connect with each other, which might be public parks, gardens, cafes, and so forth. These civic deserts are most prominent in areas where the Trump base lives. So that it's actually the working classes who have traditionally been understood as being traditionally connected through religion and other forms of neighborhood and culture as being more connected to each other. But actually, the polling is showing that the atomization and breakdown of social relationships is most acute and most pronounced among working class and lower income people, and particularly the Trump base, which is,
I mean, somewhat predictable, right? With deindustrialization, I bet you that maps almost exactly on. You go to, you know, Appalachian Ohio, there's going to be the plant that was the Walmart, and now the Walmart's closed, and everyone's a fentanyl addict. Right. So this is, I mean, this is, as a neo-Marxist, I'm sure you also link it to these obviously long-term deindustrialization. Right. Exactly. And what you show in the book is that deindustrialization is now coming for us white-collar workers, which we didn't see that coming.
We were just fine. Google and, you know, there's a lot of analysis of social media and Silicon Valley, which is sort of in the neoliberal era you referred to. You know, you began to see the rise of these new elites who are, you know, in Silicon Valley and are basically leading the charge toward the atomization of work. You know, people like Musk and Bezos are now joining with a variety of other elites to sue for deconstitutionalizing labor unions and basically creating these remote workplaces and, you know, the forms of deindustrialization. But it goes beyond that. I mean, as you say, these guys in Silicon Valley are digging their own graves. Some of the most vulnerable people who are being people who are working on the development of AI and on so forth. So I look at that analysis in the book as well. And so there's a really wide spectrum of, you know, deindustrialization, meaning or social atomization, which is taking hold in the society. Another factor that's relevant, I just want to mention because it's an important thing to me, is climate change. I mean, climate change is intensifying.
Yeah, we'll get to climate in a second. Let's stick on tech for a moment. Derek,
maybe we could talk a little bit about tech. This is an interesting phenomenon to me because some of the biggest proponents of everybody has to go back to work, we can't have everybody working at home, are the people like Elon Musk and these Silicon Valley types. But it's because the workplace that they've created is itself atomized. Like, it doesn't really matter, right? If people are working from home or if they're working in a cubicle in an office where they don't really see anybody all day because they're, you know, spending 12 hours a day coding. But can you talk a little bit about the changes to the workplace itself that have contributed to people feeling disconnected from one another?
Yeah, that's an important question. So I want to go back to this idea of the rise of a different legal concept of employment. So we had sociopathic employment, exploitative and so forth, but it was assumed a permanent relationship between the worker, not a permanent, but an enduring relationship between workers and what's happened since the neoliberal era is, and I think tech has played a role in this in a variety of ways, is that employment is no longer presumed to be a continuing relationship. Let's take Amazon and Amazon, workers in Amazon warehouses and so forth. Those guys are burned out. I mean, it's a very toxic workplace. It's typical of emerging service and, industrial places where the assumption is we want to burn workers out. We don't want to presume any kind of ongoing relationship with the worker. So, you know, when you ask what is happening to the workplace and in tech, I think tech is not the only agent here, but tech is creating conditions. I think Bezos is a perfect example of this, where it's just assumed that you don't have to worry about what happens to your worker because he's going to be gone in a year or two. People are going to be not able to continue. And there's just a model in there that work is transient. So if you look at the data on the percentage of the American labor force, which is contingent, by contingent, I mean they're either gig workers or they're part-time workers or temporary workers or independent contractors or other kinds of categories of people who are not are not really expected to be in a long-term complete and continuing relationship. So that's what I mean by, as we move from robber baron era one to robber baron era two, where the new robber barons, the most wealthy and powerful, are these tech guys in Silicon Valley. They are kind of celebrating the rise of new technologies that are going to displace workers further. These guys are really anti-union. There's no toleration of union. And like I say, both Bezos and Musk are suing for, along with Trump, for making unions unconstitutional. This is going to unravel the 1935 Wagner Act as part of the dismantling of the New Deal, which is what neoliberalism is mostly about. And so, because neoliberalism...
Well, it's not part of dismantling the military that was part of the second New Deal in the late 1940s, yes, as I've come to call it. That's just fine. It's just the social welfare part of the New Deal that they don't like.
And we should at some point talk to military about militarism because that's a really important part of this. And, the tech people, if you want to stay on tech for a minute, are becoming integrated with the national security state and with American foreign policy. So the entire infrastructure of what I call logarithmic wiring of power, which has come with tech, is being sort of enmeshed and intertwined with the national security state, with the Trump authoritarian project. You got Palantir and other data analytics company, which are basically working with the Pentagon and with the Justice Department and people in the White House to actually, as you know, build databases on all of us. Right, in which they have a master database in which all of our information, very sensitive information, is going to be available to people. And people like us who are already maybe on the cusp of being, targeted will be more easily, And what you have in Silicon Valley is not just a capitulation of Trump among people like Zuckerberg and so forth, but the rise of Peter Thiel and David Sachs and Mark Anderson and so forth, these far right people who are becoming more prominent in the sort of Trump House version of Silicon Valley and are getting the big contracts from Trump, and these people are developing a kind of technological labor and technological data analysis, which is just perfectly designed for an expansive U.S. military hegemonic agenda, as America and companies and powerful people worry about the rise of China and the rise of the decline of the American empire. So tech plays an important role in consolidating that element of political economy in the United States right now.
So why do you think that, quote unquote, we've allowed this to happen? Because to me, this really points to the undemocratic nature of American society. It's been undemocratic for almost a century at this point. I mean, it's been undemocratic the whole time, but it's been institutionally undemocratic in like the modern state form, which we could like take the 30s and the 40s as like the modern state form designed to be undemocratic, particularly in foreign policy and economy. But why do you think that they basically haven't gotten social pushback? Why do you think there hasn't been a quote unquote revolution, however you want to take that?
Yeah, well, you know, I've spent a lot of time writing and thinking about this. And and there are a lot of different answers to this question. I mean, one is the argument in the book, which is of this book I've written. This is one of a series of books I'm doing on authoritarianism. And the argument here, as you say, is it's very sociological. It's an argument that one of the foundations of the rise of authoritarianism is the breakdown of social relationships. When people are isolated, and again, remember that Trump's base is among the most atomized part of the American population, people are afraid. I mean, it was interesting when I started looking at people who are going to Trump rallies. These were people who started going to Trump rallies as a way to develop a kind of community with each other. They were the Trump Joes who were going from one and Trump women who were going, began meeting each other, you know, hours before each Trump rally and building a relationship. And then, you know, the argument that de Tocqueville and, Arendt and others were making in making this connection that is developed in this book, Bonfire, about the relationship between social relationships, social connections, and authoritarianism, is that when people are atomized and feeling alone and afraid, it's very difficult to have any kind of democratic process, because democracy assumes that there's a certain level of trust, a certain level of social cohesion, a certain level of agreement to disagree without breaking apart entirely. When people are alone, it's red meat for authoritarians, and Trump exploits this extremely, you know, effectively, because he puts himself forward and says, I understand what you're feeling, and I'm going to take care of things and make sure that you're protected. When you're afraid, alone, and feel you could, you know, you need a leader who steps forward and says, I'm going to take care of you, and only I can do that. It's a little bit like a cult phenomenon, but it's been characteristic of in Germany and fascism. Hitler used many of these same things because German workers were being completely, discombobulated by the terrible depression and so forth. But let me add that there are a lot of other factors. Why is this happening right now? One is what's happened to the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, authoritarianism has a very long history in the United States. It started with the Constitution and before. And the Constitution was never intended to be, you know, the guys that wrote the Constitution were very influenced by Magna Carta. Magna Carta, they never really tried to curb the power of the king. You know, when the country was formed,
they were concerned about the Congress. If you go back to what they're talking about, they're worried about the Congress getting too much power.
Britain was a parliamentary system at that point. The king was not a very important figure. The guys that ran America pretty much before the revolution were the same. You know, they had funny names like Rep. Jefferson and Adam Washington before the revolution, same names after the revolution running. But the Constitution was written another name for the Magna Carta in Britain was called the Article of the Barons. That was the official name of the document. It was, you know, signed in 1215 under King John. The barons in America, these guys, Jefferson and Madison, the guys who wrote the Constitution, if you look at their images, they had all kinds of pictures of the Magna Carta. It was put in the urn and the basic documents. And these guys, they kind of made a claim to limiting the power of the monarch, but it was not to create democracy in the people. It was, in the Middle Ages, the idea that serfs would become, because of the Magna Carta, or limiting the power of the monarch, would emerge was insane. You know, the serfs would never be viewed as full citizens. And the people who wrote the American Constitution it wasn't just around slavery, which was a kind of neo-fascist beginning of America, because fascism is always about racial, race-based, blood-based nationalism. So this authoritarianism goes very deep into the society, baked into the history. If you ask why is Trump getting some resonance for his kind of politics, because this form of authoritarian you know, ideology and practice runs deep in the American bloodstream. It goes all the way back to the beginning. And if we went through the stages of American history, I could point to very, very strong elements of this authoritarian, even back to the very beginning, the Constitution, the Confederacy, but all the way through.
Oh, absolutely. So that's the Indian Removal Act. There's plenty of things to point
Jackson,
to.
Yeah, there's a reason that Andrew Jackson was one of his heroes later that, you know, I mean, the America First movement in the 30s, you know, Henry Ford and the DuPonts and other major American corporate elites were happy to embrace authoritarianism and European fascism, actually, in the 30s. And so there's a whole historical element to why this is happening. But then the more recent thing, in addition to the things we've talked about tech and the breakdown of employment and the move toward a contingent employment model, and the breakdown of social relations attendant to that, there's the politics of the American electoral system and the way in which the Democratic Party, I mean, the neoliberal era, which is usually associated with Republican takeover, should not be disguised as anything but a bipartisan shift toward a kind of, you know, unrelenting sort of sociopathic capitalism, which has intensified. And Bill Clinton and Barack Obama both played very important roles, both in the military and the economic development of the neoliberal system. And the demo, if you asked why, what really is accounting for the re-election of Trump and so forth, you've got to look at what's happened with the Democratic Party since the breakdown of the late 70s, Vietnam, the breakdown of what appeared to be the viability of the New Deal economy. The right wing had been gunning for, there's a whole history since, you know, Birchers and the Goldwater and all the way into Nixon and so forth, where they were learning that there was a way to, what they really wanted to do was dismantle the New Deal.
I mean, the right wing is just the anti-New Deal coalition. There is not a genuine right wing in the United States before the 1940s. The term is barely used. The right wing, the modern conservative movement, is explicitly made as an anti-New Deal effort. Really, the way I think of it, it's an effort to repeal the progressive era. That's essentially what the modern American conservative movement does, except when it comes to the military.
I've done a history of that, which is coming out in a new book, which is called Fighting Oligarchy, which you might want to look at, and maybe we could talk further about this.
Yeah, we'll have you on when it's out, for sure.
Great. But let me just go back to the Democratic Party. So Clinton, and you know, you remember he joins this centrist kind of idea of, he makes a speech in inauguration, say America is, the Democratic Party is done with big government, with, you know, we are now the party of the center. We are embracing the idea that America is not about government or collective identity. It's about the individual moving forward. And basically, he began the process of basically moving the Democratic Party away from any kind of concept of what the New Deal legacy had meant, which was the labor, you know, development of labor unions, development of Social Security, development of Medicare, all these kinds of social programs, employment.
Well, it's a response to the stagnation of Fordism. I mean, I think it's important to base, there was a genuine stagnation in the 1970s, only due to capitalism, obviously, right? Yeah, in a different world, it wouldn't be that. So the Clinton slash Reagan response is essentially just flood the system with money through deregulation. And it turns out that that works in the short term. In the medium term, it just means that financial capital owns everything. And I think that's the situation we're in right now.
Yeah. I think that, as you said, the short-term effects were not commensurate with the long-term effects of eroding
the regulatory structures. They were great for the baby boomers, though. Baby boomers had a really fucking cool life. Unfortunately, their children don't.
And I mean, they're being eroded now in terms of Social Security and Medicare and all that kind of stuff. But basically, my argument is that the Democratic Party has evolved. And this proceeded under Obama and under, you know, with Kamala Harris and so forth, that toward, they've moved away from the kind of incipient class politics that emerged in the New Deal, where the Democratic Party spoke for, you know, the idea that the United States was organized in a predatory economic system in which ordinary people were being fleeced and, you know, robbed and, you know, disposed of. And it moved away from that whole kind of analysis and said, this is the Democratic Party speaking, we embrace the American dream, the individualistic American dream, the American market, the free market, and we're going to focus on, you know, some form of what is now called identity politics. That is, we're going to focus on what I call siloed identity politics, by which I mean a focus on crucial issues involving race and gender identification and so forth. But the way the Democratic Party moved in this direction, one is it was associated with a full-scale rejection of class politics. Even, and America has always had very weak class politics. But the New Deal began to develop, you know, some elements of European social democracy, which has made an important difference in the post-World War II development of Europe compared to the United States.
Yeah, but the Cold War cut it off. I mean, this is the big hinge point, right? In my opinion, once Harry Truman and his attorney general start going after the left in the late 1940s, the sort of limits on the American liberal adaptation of social democracy become pretty clear. The militarism, we got the military Keynesianism, but now we just got rid of the Keynesianism, right. And now we're just with the militarism.
Well, you know, there was a period where in the mid-60s.
I mean, just very quickly, so much of that middle class boost in the 50s and 60s is linked to defense production. It just is. The work has been done. Yes. And so that's a big problem.
But, you know, in the, even you go through Johnson, the Great Society, which was had remnants of the New Deal. He expanded it, in an important way. There was still an element of class politics there and labor issues.
Absolutely.
Nixon even, you know, Nixon proposed the New Deal regime. I've done an analysis of American regime change, in a book called Regime Change Begins at Home. And I argue that the New Deal regime really extended from the 30s when Roosevelt came in up until Reagan in 1980 when there was.
Really, I totally agree.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
So you had a kind of New Deal element in the Democratic Party. And even in Nixon had to sort of abide by certain elements of New Deal thinking up until the late 70s. But then with Clinton and the rise of this new, you know, tech elite and all the things we've already talked about, we see the Democratic Party fully abandoning class politics. Now, I should say Biden made some exception to that. We can talk about that. But the Democratic Party has moved toward what I call siloed identity politics. And what I mean by that is a focus not on class, but on race and gender decoupled from class issues. This is toxic to the prospect of democracy and to the Democratic Party because it pits the Democratic Party base against each other. It pits black versus brown, males versus whites, males versus females. It puts in the language all kinds of things about which Hillary Clinton was famous for. You know, these are deplorable people, these white working people who are so bigoted racially.
Hey, well, regulating the banks and racism, Charles, this is the thing that I ask myself every night before I go to sleep.
So, you know, when you ask, why is this happening now? It's not surprising when a society is deprived of any political expression, political party that is speaking to issues, fundamental issues of class, which are central to American society and capitalism, that these kinds of, you know, breakdowns in social relationships, in economic security, all these. So the working classes of America, you know, remember 60% or more of American voters are not college educated. They're destined for lower low income service sector jobs, as, you know, industrial jobs are, and as unions are being carved up and, you know, broken apart and so forth. So you've got a majority population facing real disaster. If you sort of compared, you know, the authoritarianism of America today with that of the Europeans in the 30s, well, they had, like in Germany, you had a much more drastic economic, you know, situation in Germany, for example, in the 30s. But if you look at the actual economic conditions facing the great majority of workers who are, you know, particularly workers who are in the Trump base, you're seeing a lot of desperation. You're seeing, you know, both socially, culturally, and the cultural element here, where they feel sort of dissed, you know, like they're not seen, they're not recognized as, you know, important people. A lot of that is coming from Democratic arguments about racial prejudice among white working class people and so forth. And the whole way in which the Democratic Party has embraced identity politics has been a repudiation of the kind of politics that could have stopped Trumpism, that could have stopped the way, particularly the second term of Trump, that could have possibly moved American white working class people, American males, from this, from a Democrat, this migration of working class people from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party has been going on, as you guys know, for 30 or 40 years. I think it's the most important, eruption in American politics. And it's at the heart of Trumpism and the rise of authoritarianism. Because
it's almost like the Democrats have other concerns. It's almost like they don't even really want to win elections. It's almost like they care more about the consultant checks.
So, Charles, you talked earlier, you mentioned earlier, and we said we were going to get back to this, about climate change. And there's a chapter in the book that deals with climate change and other types of environmental disruptions, COVID being, probably the one that sticks in people's heads the most right now. But talk about what these kinds of things, natural disasters, the intensifying effects of climate change, the effect of the pandemic and everybody kind of being isolated during that period. What has this all done to intensify sociocidal tendencies that you're talking about?
Well, thank you, Derek, for bringing that up again, because it is important. So, I do believe that we're moving into an era as the environment continues to spiral into existential, peril, where sociocidal forces are going to become more acute. So as climate change, 60% of people in America live by the ocean. Live by the coast. Climate change, raises obviously the water level, land, inhabitable land in Florida on the coasts is going to continue to decline. Here I'm in Massachusetts, Cape Cod is beginning to sink. So one of the effects of climate change is going to be, and this is happening, of course, globally as well, in areas like Bangladesh, where millions and millions of people are living already in delta areas underwater, is that it forces migration, which leads to more competition between people for inhabitable space. And that simply intensifies this kind of competitive, sort of breakdown of viable, sustainable relations between people as they're turned. I mean, the economy is turning them, pitting them against each other for jobs. Now, the environmental crisis is pitting people against each other for basic survival needs, and the costs of living. And you can't, if you live in Florida, many parts of Florida, you can't buy insurance. There's just all kinds of things attendant to climate change that are going to increase the economic and cultural pressures on people who are already feeling they're battling to stay alive and to stay connected to other people. And I think, again, as climate change intensifies, people become more competitive with each other because the available resources that are available for survival decline. And this increases this sociocidal kind of breakdown of social trust and relations, which is connected with gun violence and which leads to these broader authoritarian trends where people feel, I can't know that my brother Derek really is going to look out for me. I need a leader who I'm willing to give up a lot, make sure this leader is going to take care of me and make sure that I'm safe. And so I think climate change plays into these social forces that are atomizing people, making them more distrustful, more social cohesion is going to break down further as the available land and resources that are being eroded by climate change continue to put enormous psychological pressure on people. I mean, I do want to say here, Derek, that I said earlier, which is that one of the reasons I wrote this book is I wanted Americans think in very personal terms. And, I wanted to help people understand that these authoritarian disasters that are emerging right now have very personal elements to them in the way that our personal relationships are changing with each other, in the family, in the workplace, and so forth. And climate change is going to play, it's another layering of social forces that are going to intensify people's sense of isolation, people's fear, people's need for guns, people's need for that leading toward political violence and toward more authoritarianism and so forth. So that there is a chapter in the book both about gun violence and about climate change. The public health crisis leading to COVID is also a factor here, because if we get a bird flu or another round of COVID, that of course also clearly intensifies sociocidal things, because literally relationships become dangerous. If I'm sitting with you in a room, Derek, I have to be worried that you might make me sick, because we can't trust each other. You can tell me you might not want to wear a mask. I don't know how you're actually feeling. So, and this gets into all kinds of things. In COVID, it was very clear that because we have this
50-50 today, just to put it out.
Well, I guess our online connection makes it a little bit safer to talk to you. But, you can see that in families. Married couples wonder what kind of sharing, when one has COVID and one doesn't, is possible. And issues of trust, even in marriage or in families, come up, as to what kind of safety people feel. So, again, I just want to say that the public health crisis plays a role here, like the climate crisis, and it intensifies the level of fear and distrust that people are experiencing. And that's just a red meat recipe for authoritarianism. The more people are feeling afraid, disconnected, distrustful of other people, feel they can't rely on people around them, they look to a strong leader to take over and ensure security.
Yeah, it feels like a cyclical thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. It keeps building.
There's, or people start to think I can't rely on anybody, and then it just intensifies.
Right, exactly.
Is that you're talking about? And I think another one of those, which you alluded to in your last answer, is the gun culture.
Yes.
Gun culture is not a new thing. I mean, it's not, America didn't fall in love with guns over the last 40 or 50 years. That's been embedded in American culture all this time. But what's new to me is the idea that somebody rings my doorbell, I'm going to fire six shots into the door.
Right.
Be safe, just in case. That's where things really seem to have gone off the rails. So can you talk about, and it's not just guns, obviously, it's the whole militarization culture, the excess emphasis on the military as the one institution that is still good in America, basically. That's seems to be the attitude. The notion, the proliferation of more military-esque firearms and weapons to everyday citizens. Just talk about this whole phenomenon, which again seems to be both caused by and then exacerbates the tendency to tear ourselves apart.
Yeah, so that's a hugely important and big subject, Derek. Thanks for bringing it up. It's interesting just to make that connection, and I'll come back to it, about between war and gun culture and sociocide. American, the first gun company in America began around the time of the Civil War, slightly before, but really became massive when Americans in the Civil War recognized that other Americans could take used guns against them. And gun culture, the NRA began shortly in 1870, shortly after the Civil War. And the gun culture began to intensify in that period. But as you say, America has long been in love with guns, but there's a lot of that was historically related to hunting and, sport. Now, women, you probably know that guns are being designed for children as well. There's a huge market for a new market for female designed guns. Why are women buying guns? Not because they want to hunt. When the interviews show that they're afraid, they feel that they're not safe without guns, and they need guns to protect themselves. And maybe their kids. Guns are being designed for infants now, for children, 3 or 4 year old children. And so this is becoming a family dynamic. And we're seeing new parts of the population. This is part of the new elements of the gun culture, sort of buy guns out of fear. It's part of this atomization that we've been talking about, sociocide. In a sociocidal culture, everybody's at war in some sense with each other. There's no real sense of safety and belonging. And so, you know, we have about 340 million Americans right now. The number of Americans, number of guns, privately owned guns in America is about 450 million. So there are more guns than there are people. And that's growing rapidly, that rate. And so the gun culture is intensifying. It's becoming much more centered around both personal safety that's related to these issues of American sociocide and political violence, because political violence has also massively expanded under, you know, that's part of an authoritarian era as well. And so, you know, 40% of Americans are now saying that they expect a civil war to be likely, or and or to say, close to half the population, to say that they personally feel that they might have to be armed to survive politically in the United States. So there's a kind of grim view by the public, which is understandable, you know, as you know, the blue states and the red states start really dividing around election issues and gerrymandered districts and voting mail-in ballots and all the things that Trump is currently emphasizing. People are feeling that we might be moving toward, I mean, this is the dominant view in America right now, we might be moving toward a civil war. People need to be armed. And it's just a growing, you know, a matter of growing concern as Trump continues. Now, I want to link that to what the very important point you made, Derek, about guns and the military. Because, as I say, there's long been a historic connection between wars and domestic violence and gun violence at home. And that began in the Civil War when Americans began to realize, oh, yeah, other Americans can really shoot each other and you might need safety from that. I think, you know, the newest element of that, I mean, America has been militarizing, you know, ever since, you know, the very beginning. And as America became the world's hegemonic force and militarized everything, you know, there's never a separation between violence abroad and violence at home. You know, I mean, when Martin Luther King, you know, was running the civil rights leadership, he was saying, how can I possibly support, you know, a civil rights movement at home against violence that is being perpetrated, you know, in the South and at home around the country, when Americans are using the same exact violence against people abroad in Vietnam? And so he, contrary to his many of his advisors, he said, I can't lead a civil rights movement or be part of a civil rights movement that's not opposing the violence that America is perpetrating around the world. And, you know, King was on to something very important there, which is that, you know, the military is inherently part of an authoritarian system. You know, I mean, America has been imposing, I mean, we could spend hours talking about, you know, Central America, El Salvador, Cuba, Nicaragua, or the Middle East, or Southeast Asia, where the United States has repeatedly gone in, overthrown. Look at Chile, for example, and, you know, overthrowing the Allende democratically elected regime, putting in Pinochet, a dictator. I mean, that's a model that has been reproduced over and over and over again. So it's hard to say for anybody to take seriously the idea of America as a democratic society when it's imposing in the name of anti-communism or fighting terrorism. This became more pronounced after 9/11, of course, and the Patriot Act and so forth. It all came together to intensify this sort of melding of you know, violence at home and, you know, militarized violence abroad, now extending very explicitly with Trump, but using the military to enforce domestic policing and domestic control at home. So I just came back from Chicago. It's a great city to come. He's now going to be pushing, you know, National Guard, federalizing National Guard in Chicago, as well as New York and D.C. This right. is really important because it's melding the historic American foreign military kind of authoritarianism and awful kind of repression. It's now being brought into the domestic, you know, control of the population. So the military is going to be a feature of domestic policing and domestic social control and political control. That's the nature of authoritarianism, is to use the police or the military to actually enforce, you know, American order at home. So the combination of domestic violence coming that we talked about with the guns and with sociocidal forces, with the authoritarian political violence that's endemic to authoritarianism as a political regime, I really worry, Derek, about the intensification of this. I mean, the militarization. I mean, America has been able to have a partial, you know, buffer of the kind of authoritarian, extreme authoritarian fascist regimes that it imposes globally on the world from what it does domestically at home. That line is now eroding. And I think we're seeing, you know, the use of the military to police American cities is, I think, symbolic of a broader shift in the way in which American militarism is diffusing into a sociocidal society and sort of creating conditions under which military operations that are routine abroad and becoming incredibly intense in, you know, after 9/11 and in the Middle East and so forth are going to be brought home. And we're already seeing that, the level, you know, the intensification of political violence. It's all over the place. I mean, even the mainstream parties are afraid to speak out for fear of, you know, their families being attacked or whatever. I'm in a university, the fear of violence. I get threats. I'm sure you probably have gotten some threats. There is just a level of amplification that I think is rising and will rise further as, you know, military forces are brought into the governance of American cities and America. Right. And so it's sort of a natural phenomenon in sociocidal societies as people are more afraid, become more angry, people arm up, and, you know, both in terms of neighborhood life and political life, violence becomes endemic and part of the American scene. So it's another along, you know, it's another extremely dangerous and serious thing. And you can't separate American foreign policy anymore, which has always been super authoritarian in the way it operates in the world with, that's, by the way, one of the reasons I think so many people are interested in the resistance in the United States to Trump, because people abroad are accustomed to seeing American troops police their countries or put in dictators who run their societies. And now they see this is happening to Americans at home, and they're rooting for the Americans who are trying to come out and saying, this is not what we want. More Americans have to realize that what's happening at home is a reflection of partly of what America has been doing abroad for, you know, decades. So we might want to talk a little bit more about that, about how that plays into the role of resistance to Trump and what's involved in trying to challenge American authoritarianism.
Yeah, I think maybe as a sort of concluding question, we can talk about that. I do want to talk a little bit more about Silicon Valley. I want to come back to Silicon Valley for a moment, but maybe as a concluding question, we can sort of talk about resistance and what that might look like. I think, I mean, to your point, I'm watching, you know, what he's planning to do or what he seems to be ramping up to in Chicago with a lot of concern, because not just because I lived in Chicago and I love that city, but it really feels like the point of no return, right? Like the DC Act was an action to put National Guard troops on the streets of that city is a test case, but it's also a unique case because of the prerogative that the federal government has over DC. But to go into another city in the same way is just like we're throwing the whole kit and caboodle in the trash, and we're just going to do what we want. And nobody's going to stop us.
I assure you,
it really does feel
like it's
a dangerous point. As I say, I want to just before we get into sort of what the resistance may look like, or you know, questions of what people can do. I wanted to come back to Silicon Valley. We talked about them in the context of atomizing the workplace and atomizing workers, but they're atomizing society. I mean, social media. Now we've got the rise of AI and people interacting with AI more than they interact with other human beings. Like social media, I was found this fascinating. It has been talked about as this liberating thing. Like it's a way for people to communicate with each other all over the place and, you know, to potentially resist authoritarian. It's been cast as a way to resist authoritarianism. But I think what it really does is it liberates us from one another. Like, right. We don't interact with one another anymore. We interact with the computer or the phone. And through that medium, there's somebody on the other end, but you don't really think of them in the same terms as if you were sitting and talking to somebody or in a public place and kind of, you know, running into people in a physical way. So can you talk a little bit about social media and now AI as well, which just seems to be an intensification of the phenomenon where we're not even interacting with a person on the other end. We're interacting with this computer system. Well,
thank you for bringing us back to that, because it's really important. I have a couple of chapters in the book which really deal with the meaning of the shift toward electronic communication, not just social media, though, but, you know, the internet broadly, AI and robotics. And I don't know if you knew this, but people are marrying their AI partners. Now you can go on to, Gemini or something.
I think there's a whole Reddit forum. Yeah. I mean, Reddit, another thing.
People are literally marrying.
A whole Reddit forum for that, yeah.
So it's interesting because, as you point out, tech presented itself, Silicon Valley presented itself as providing a whole new world of social connection, you know, that we would be able to connect with people everywhere in the world and that we could build networks. You know, Facebook said you can have friends everywhere around the world and in your own hometown, people in your neighborhood, people. It seemed like just a magical flowering, sort of an antidote to sociocide, a way of newly connecting people to each other and building relationships online. In the book, what I show is using a lot of data and analysis of people who have studied this in more care, for example, there's a book called Surveillance Capitalism, which is about Silicon Valley, Shoshana Zuboff's book, which is about Silicon Valley. There's another book called Alone Together, which is about the nature of relationships created in social media and so forth. And it's important to say that, as in all parts of life, contradiction is important here. There are ways in which social media can help connect people and build kinds of connections. And even in resistance, you know, the fact that we can connect with people overseas who are fighting their own authoritarian battles or with people next door in the neighborhood that we didn't know in neighborhood groups, there is capacity for building new relationships through social media. But the overwhelming force is, I call this logarithmic capitalism, or logarithmic control, is because these relationships are being mediated by, you know, rules and influencers who are relatively, as you point out, invisible to us. We don't know the logarithms. We don't know the people who are basically sort of determining what kind of messages we see online, what kinds of influencers, who are these influencers. I talk a lot to my students about this because I teach at Boston College, and the students say that they are online 4 or 5 hours a day. And I say, well, how do you feel about the connections you're making to your fellow, you know, peers? Because you're now an internet generation, a social media generation. They're almost uniformly saying they're totally distrustful of what's happening to them online. They feel that the influencers who are that they follow, they have no idea whether they're commercial influencers, political influencers that they don't understand. There's a lot of mystery and distrust, sort of like the distrust that's building, you know, offline, is being intensified online as people are being sort of routed into communities or, you know, networks of people that they don't really understand, who they don't really know what's driving behind them. I'm just now repeating what they tell me. They tell me that while they're on a large amount of time, there's a lot of kind of seductive power of the imagery, of the kind of ease of communicating through video and through these kinds of online connections. I mean, it's amazing to me what percentage of the young people are saying, I don't trust it. I don't feel, they say, my real friends I don't connect with. I might text with them a little bit online, but I'm not using Instagram or TikTok to really connect with people that I know well. That they're doing that through either in person or other channels. So I think that you're absolutely right to say the sociocidal forces broadly of tech, being generated by tech, it goes beyond the employment relationship and the breakdown of the workplace to the whole model of communication in the culture and in our larger social life, that the online world is a potentially sociocidal disaster. It moves people away from face-to-face relationships toward mediated relationships with people through a mechanism of control, which is relatively invisible to people, which guides the nature of the information and the nature of the connections that they experience. And they just tell me, this was not my knowledge. They just tell me flat out, and it's been very consistent, that they don't trust it and they feel that they're more isolated in many ways. They don't look to these social media as ways of really building real friendship and real social community and so forth. So I think that's a big point. And it needs to be tied also to authoritarianism in the sense that, as we said earlier, these data companies like Palantir and other companies like Facebook and Meta and so forth are working with national security and military companies to collect data on people. And Silicon Valley is becoming, in my view, partly an adjunct of the national security state. You know, it's sort of working very tightly in forms of data collection of the population and control of communication. From a Trumpist point of view, it's also very important in the control of how people understand science and truth. You know, they believe that, I mean, one of the things that basically, you know, the way that people like Zuckerberg say as well, we're libertarians, we're just going to let anything out there. So things that are right, completely anti-vaccine theories or whatever, anything goes. And I'm a very free speech guy myself, but I think that the danger of this kind of modeling of communication and information flow on the net in the hands of a small number of people, we're talking about, you know, trillion-dollar companies among, you know, 7 or 8, 10 billion multi-billionaires, richest people in the universe. And these people are moving toward a more conservative, militarized, capitalist kind of model, different from the historic, you know, back in their beginning days, they were more centrist or leaning Democratic in their voting. That's begun to change dramatically, and it's accelerated in the Trump era, as they see that the big money from the government, you know, and all with all their libertarian spirit, they're in fact totally dependent on massive government. You know, I mean, Musk is, you know, making billions of dollars off of his SpaceX projects that from the government, from both from American government, from governments abroad that the American government aligns with around military and space issues and so forth. So these guys are, you know, embedded in militarized capitalism in a way that's frightening. And they're both redirecting it and influenced by it and being shaped by it. And it's, as you suggest, Derek, it's reconstructing the nature of social relationships and social community and playing a very, very important role in the rise of political authoritarianism, because it's controlling information, what people come to accept as true. It's not accidental that, I mean, authority, you remember in 1984, I expect to see more and more of this, that the telescreen, what was called George Orwell called the 3-minute hate, where the public was rallied together to scream and yell against the enemy. It could be a domestic enemy or it could be an enemy abroad. And that's sort of what I imagine is going to emerge more and more fully in the United States, where people are going to, particularly in the Trump base, are going to have, they're already in it. There's a right-wing ecosystem where every day you're getting the 3-minute hate, you know, where you're learning about the people who are risking your livelihood and risking your safety and are un-American, starting with the aliens and the immigrants, but then going to the people who are supporting them, who are government workers or are liberals or, you know, whatever. So I see, you know, the tech world as becoming a really important central mediating force, which is translating the political, you know, power of the traditional far right in America, mainstreaming it into the media culture and the eco culture. Thank God for people like you guys who are, you know, maintaining some sort of independent, you know, voice for people. But I think media itself is already being swallowed up by all the different avenues that social media has produced.
Yeah, it goes beyond, I guess, just cutting people off from one another. Like the whole foundation of an objective reality that people are sharing is gone, right? I mean, it's sort of dissipated. We can't even agree on what reality is,
and
let alone communicate with one another.
And that's become part of Palantir and Meta and Alphabet. These guys have pretty much bought into that kind of epistemology, that there is no objective truth. And, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that everything has bias to it, that the science itself is driven by, but there are historical and other, but they are sort of shredding any idea of, you know, consensual, you know, values and consensual objectivity. It's all whatever you make up and whatever is going to make money for them. So I think that the whole epistemology, that is the way we understand truth and the way we come to understand things as real, the tech world is making that more and more challenging. And that plays right into authoritarianism, because authoritarianism is based on the idea that truth is whatever the dominant leader of the country is saying. And so Trump is, you know, working, you know, he inaugurated himself in that picture, you know, when he was reelected with those seven billionaires from Silicon Valley. It wasn't accidental, I think, that, you know, he was immediately embedding himself. And then they were capitulating and building this kind of new robber baron era where, you know, you're seeing incredibly wealthy people with a lot of economic and cultural power aligning with a more authoritarian government to run the state and to with the military. So it's a grim picture.
So as our final question, you talk a lot in the book, you know, kind of woven into the book, are ways that people might be able to resist this, or things that people can do, or what a resistance might look like. And you alluded to that earlier, and I wanted to give you sort of the final word here as things seem to be spinning more and more out of people's hands. I mean, it really feels that
right,
way.
Right, it does.
What can we do to reverse that and try to step back from the brink?
So I don't want to be Pollyannish about this question. You know, in the 30s, European fascism, once a fascist took power, whether it was in Spain with Franco or Italy with Mussolini, or, there was no resistance left. You know, it took the World War II, to basically destroy, you know, Hitler's power and Mussolini's power and so forth. Nonetheless, maybe because I'm a bit of a hopeful person and because I look at history, and I've done a lot of writing about the history of social movements in the United States. And despite the deep authoritarian history that I've developed in this book and other books that I've been writing recently, these books are full of analysis of historical dynamics of social movements. I mean, you can go back to the first Gilded Age, the first robber barons, and you had a populist movement, which was a complex movement. It had elements that were not, you know, and they ended up melding with the Democratic Party. They create in 1892, the populists, who were mostly farmers being screwed by Wall Street, couldn't afford the credit. You know, it was a credit sort of system that was giving the early Wall Street people a ton of money, but farmers, you know, most of America was farmers at that point. They couldn't survive, and the railroads were making credit impossible. So the populists got together, and they were kind of the first anti-oligarchy, you know, pro-democracy kind of movement. It was a really exciting movement. It was mostly agrarian, but it tied in with the Knights of Labor and some urban immigrant. Didn't get a lot of traction in immigrant urban America at the time. Although you had people like Eugene Debs, who was both a socialist and anti-war, was jailed by Woodrow Wilson, as you know, in 1918 for asking people not to join the draft. But my reading of American history is that there is a substantial force that's been recurrent in American history where people rise up and say enough. And, you know, the populists were one example of that. The historian Lawrence Goodwin, who wrote a book called The Populist Moment, a famous history of the populists. This was left populism, not far right populism. He says that was the most democratic moment of American history. I go on to look at, you know, the rise of the anti-war movement in World War I, where you had Woodrow Wilson, who's often seen as a liberal, was an incredibly, you know, right-wing force. He was arresting anybody. You know, the Alien and Sedition Act was passed in 1918. He was arresting Debs, who was a candidate for president at the time. And they were arresting people fighting, you know, challenging World War I, which was basically a war fought to reward the Morgan interests who had invested heavily in Britain and didn't want to see their money go down the tube if the United States didn't bail, you know, England out. And then you go to the New Deal and you get this, you know, during the Depression, this massive uprising of workers who are occupying factories and, you know, challenging, you know, their neighbors who are being thrown out of their apartments because they couldn't pay the rent in Chicago and New York and elsewhere. And so I look a lot at that movement as well. And I look at this whole, and then back, I was sort of myself a young person in the 1960s and 70s. And I look at that movement of the, I was in the South organizing for, against a very authoritarian, you know, racist. I was in Mississippi for quite a while organizing Black people to vote. And because they didn't have the right to vote then, and the Democratic Party did, we had to create a Democratic Party that would allow, you know, Black people to be part of the Democratic Party. And then I was heavily involved and frequently in jail for my protests of Vietnam and so forth. So I have my own personal and long history, which has led me to believe when I look at the resistance today, I'm really quite encouraged in many ways, you know, in, like I say, in many fascist societies, any kind of resistance at all has been destroyed very quickly. You know, Hitler by the 6 months in had basically destroyed all the opposition parties, taken totally over the media, had basically started murdering his opponents. And there was no opposition left at all. I mean, he was dictating all the news down to the details. You know, Goebbels had been made head of his Ministry of Enlightenment and propaganda. And in the United States today, the repression has become, Trump has moved very quickly. That's what authoritarians tend to do. But there's still room for forms of resistance. I mean, you and I can talk and not be shot immediately and that sort of thing. And the book Bonfire that we've been talking about, it shows that one of the things I argue is that one of the good things about movements is, particularly in a sociocidal society, is movements are about building connections. They're all about people coming together. I mean, many of my own best experiences in the movements is coming to get to know people who I really developed lifelong friendships with, and where, you know, these movements develop cultures which are themselves, just like the Trump rallies became foundations for the Trump base to find connection. You know, social movements against war and against for democracy and for, you know, against corporate power are also venues by which people can combat. So people on the left need these connections as well. And so I have, you know, I have a lot of respect for the people who are showing up in the streets. I wasn't sure that the amount of repression of immigrants and, you know, the whole war on aliens, which is central to authoritarianism, now central to Trump, the police state, to go after and deport, you know, detain and deport immigrants, would get such enormous support. You know, and people are resisting in red states or across the country when their neighbors who are, you know, working in diners or, you know, are, you know, cleaning in their nursing homes or whatever. These people are being, the ordinary Americans are standing up and saying, hey, this ain't right. This is something that's outrageous, that are the people we know that we care about who have been taking care of us and we're part of our community are being, you know, rounded up and detained and deported without any kind of due process. And so I see, actually, I mean, millions of people, you know, there's a variety of studies that say about when about 3.5% of the population gets mobilized in resistance activity, and this is based on the work of a number of Harvard scholars and other people who study social movements, that 3.5% rule is a very rough rule. But we're over that in the United States. It's about 10 or 12 million people who have that number have already in America been involved in protest activity against Trump and against the war. So I think that there is a foundation. The fact that labor is beginning to revive itself as a political force, that there are forces in, I mean, almost all the major unions now, including the AFL-CIO, but the service unions, the teachers union, the nurses union, and so forth, are finding ways to express opposition to Trump, and to be partly because Trump is joining Musk and Bezos in trying to make unions unconstitutional. So I also think that part of the prospect for change is that we're seeing sectors of the Democratic Party beginning to wake up a little bit. So you've got, you know, the Fight Oligarchy tour with, you know, Bernie Sanders and AOC. I don't know if you saw this, Derek, but Nate Silver, the pollster, said that his polling is all showing that AOC may well be the presidential candidate for the Democrats in 2028. And meanwhile, that's we're seeing Mamdani, you know, and people like him. There's a real anger at the Democratic Party for what it's become and how it's abandoned. You know, we kept talking about the abandonment of the New Deal, the abandonment of American workers. Biden played some role in reviving a little bit of attention to these things, but his relentless militarism and his refusal to challenge the sort of basic framework by which America was relating to the rest of the world, particularly in the Middle East, but more broadly, has just led, I think, to a period in which people are really fundamentally questioning the sort of post-New Deal elements of the, you know, that came out of the Clinton and even the Obama years and are looking for something different. I think they're sometimes associating that with a generational change, which I think is not necessarily the only answer here. But I think the movement toward a real challenge of both the authoritarian corporate regime that's in bed. I mean, Trump has redistributed wealth upward from the poor and working people to the trillionaires that are, you know, sort of running America right now. And I think they're seeing more and more people like Senator Murphy of Connecticut or, you know, maybe Westmore in Maryland or maybe Merkley in Oregon. I mean, there are Democrats who are stepping out a little bit more. And I think we're going to see, I mean, I'm worried that the populace in 1892, when they were fighting the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Morgans, they wanted a program for public control of Wall Street. And people should look at the history of this and the People's Party. It was a great program, but it got watered down when they joined in with the Democratic Party in 1896 and the whole populist movement was basically faded away. So there's danger. I mean, I raise that historically just to say it's a very complicated question of how grassroots resistance relates to an established party. I've always said that, you know, there are two parties in America, Bush and Bush Light, you know, and neither one of those is what we need right now. And I think the Democrats have collapsed into the kind of Bush Light thing, particularly around militarism and national security, but also corporate and labor issues of lack of a class politics. So I think we've got a lot of work to do. But like I say, I was not anticipating that the numbers of people would come out, you know, who would be really, you can see it in the creativity and the anger of people all over the country about what's happening to immigrants and to basic rights in the United States. I see that as a sign of hope. And like I say, in a sociocidal society, there's an attraction to these community-based kinds of political expressions because there are way people who are more disconnected or connecting only online can meet each other on the streets and hug each other and, you know, show their creativity with their signs and their courage with their walking on the street. And so I think that there, you know, there are elements of American authoritarianism that give more hope than existed, for example, in the 30s in Europe to the possibility of effective resistance. I don't mean to be Pollyannish about this. I think we could be in for a very grim, you know, long period. We are in for a grim long period. But I also see a strong potential for a different kind of politics emerging, challenging both the militarism, the corporatism, and the, you know, the authoritarianism that's dominating the country right now. And I think that we're going to see a lot of possibilities emerging for this. I want people to know that this book, Bonfire and American Sociocide, that I'm talking about, while it is grim, it's very deeply historical about how deep the authoritarian forces are in American society, that the book also, and my work generally, has been very focused on the role of these historical democratic movements, and they have a lot to teach us. And so I think, again, people should learn that history and also look at what's happening on the streets. And it involves wrestling with your own fear. Most people I know, and I live in a relatively, as a as an academic privileged sector society, but almost everybody I know is afraid. They're afraid to teach what they want to teach. My students are afraid. Fear is very, very pervasive. And the only way you deal with fear, well, there are a lot of ways to deal with fear, but it's important that you connect with other people together and don't like, I mean, isolation is a breeding ground for fear. People who are isolated are almost always more likely to go into themselves. And so I think finding ways to connect with people, sometimes it will be online and sometimes it will be on the streets or in workplaces or wherever, in churches, wherever it is. But I think that, you know, if you take the analysis of sociocide and bonfire seriously, you say one of our only hopes is the building of these social connections through these kinds of coming together. You know, you're either going to buy more guns. You know, the Americans, we talked about guns. The gun ownership is concentrated. About 20% of Americans have more than 20 guns in their household. You know, they're building private arsenals, and that's happening with political things as well. You're either going to go that direction, get more isolated and more loaded up with guns, or you're going to connect with people and find a way of, you know, building connections with labor groups, with community groups, with progressive anti-war groups and so forth to build. Because the alternative is to sort of retreat into yourself, which is a world of potential fear and surrender. And just like universities and law firms have capitulated out of fear as they begin to build now, you know, mutual defense pacts. I mean, a mutual defense pact is in a way a starting point for a collective resistance, the rebuilding of a kind of common sense of we. I started out by saying, you know, we live in this society of me, me, me. We're probably the most me-directed society in the world. And that moving toward a society with a sense of collective identity is very hard in a capitalist society like America, a very individualistic society. But it's incredibly important in what we're facing today. And I have every belief it's possible, in fact, probable, that eventually we will find our way out through these kinds of movements. But it's going to take a lot of resistance and a lot of courage to get through.
I think on that note, we will leave it there. The book, again, Bonfire, American Sociocide, Broken Relations, and the Quest for Democracy. Charles Derber, thank you so much for coming on the program. This has been I think, enlightening, and maybe hopefully people will take some ray of hope away from it, that there's a way forward. So thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me very much, Derek. And I hope you can encourage people to look at the book because it is very personal. I mean, even people who are not, more than most political analysis, it looks at the way in which authoritarian politics is intertwined with the transformation of social life and our relationships at home, at school, in the workplace, and so forth. And I think you would acknowledge that my writing tends to be pretty accessible. It's not academic writing.
Definitely.
You don't have to have, you know, a college degree even to read this kind of work. And so I hope people will take a look at it.
Yeah, we'll have purchase link, at least one purchase link in the show description.
Great.
So yeah, definitely check out the book,
okay,
folks. I think it's an important one and you'll get a lot out of it. But Charles, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Derek, great to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.